This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I made a really unfortunate step, apparently on an undercut, and felt the ground give way beneath me.
But you know, if you laid off on it, you might lose it.
Then I was in free fall for about 70 feet onto basically a bed of solid rock.
Because the guy had told me, you're going to be handcuffed and flown to Honolulu and held for trial.
No brain damage, no spinal damage, no ribs.
He said, well, make up your mind. Which are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm not going to stop.
Can I make it through the next 5 minutes? The next hour?
Exactly what many of the American labor force are asking themselves daily. Hello and welcome. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. I'm Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
I mean, who did you think it was, Rush Limbaugh? There's this huge urge in the media for people to identify themselves, like they're trying not to forget. Anyway,
from our studio in Sebastopol, California, where it is now the rainy season and everything is coming up green.
Yes.
It's been particularly fascinating to me to realize, looking at parts that have been bare ground and now are coming up green, and realizing there's going to be a whole lot of different plants growing here, but every single one of them, the first little whistle out of the ground that they do is all alike. There are these two little uniform leaves. Everybody
yes.
comes up the same. And then once they think it's safe to be there, then they get diverse.
Then they go nuts. And this show is about journeys. Three stories today about, well, we argued about this. I said, it's about risk.
And I said, no, it's not. It's not about the risk. It's about what it is that makes you keep going with incredible force from one moment to the next in a journey instead of just kind of doing what comes next. Some people go like an unstoppable river, and what makes them do that?
So?
First story, Amy Racina.
We opened our email one day, and there was a note on our local list, Wilderness Hiker Rescued. I'm not really sure why I even opened it. I don't care anything about wilderness hikers. But I did, and oh my God, it's Amy, a friend. She's alive, and we hadn't even known that she almost wasn't.
I broke two pieces in my right thigh. It's where the bone connects and fits into the pelvic bone. So there were two breaks there, and then a hairline fracture in the femur. The worst looking injury, and maybe the one that will take the longest to heal, was the right knee, where when I first saw it, there was actually a bone sticking right through the skin. My leg was bent at an angle, and the kneecap was basically torn in half, shattered, dislocated right ankle with a few other small fractures. Chipped tooth, perhaps a broken nose, you know, a couple sprained fingers and wrists and additional bruising, but none of that is a big deal.
So I asked, what brought you to that point in life?
Yeah, this was my third big trip this year. I did a solo trip of 100 miles just 2.5 weeks previous to this trip. We always went camping when I was a kid a lot, mostly car camping. But the first big backpack experience was when I was 16 years old. And my dad, who was a California native, took my 13-year-old brother and I was like this, you know, scrawny 16-year-old girl. He took us to his favorite place in the High Sierra, and he hiked us up over a 12,000-foot pass the first day. I think it was 13 incredibly grueling miles, and down into a place called the Kern River Canyon. And it was the most breathtaking place I had ever been. It was just, I was just awestruck, and I was absolutely exhausted. It was the most difficult thing I'd ever done in my life. I didn't think I was going to make it every step of the way. And we were out there a week, and by the time I got back, I was hooked. Well, people have a lot of fear pictures about the wilderness, and I run into this a lot. They would go, aren't you terrified to go out there? And I was never given the impression that I should be fearful. You know, it's beautiful, it's clean, there aren't pollutants, there are very few psychopaths that are willing to hike that far to do their psychopathic thing. You know, backpackers don't carry heavy firearms with them. People tend to be really calm and mellow. Road rage is almost unheard of out on the Muir Trail. So I don't really understand why people consider this to be an extreme risk. Talking about the courage it takes to go into the unknown, but the wilderness is not an unknown thing for me. I've spent 25 years soloing in the High Sierra, and I'm very familiar with it. I know what I'm doing. I'm a careful person. I don't consider it to be high risk. A lady in the room next to me in the hospital in Fresno had very similar injuries. She had been climbing a flight of steps. You know, so I'm not quite sure how I was putting myself at more risk than people do in their everyday lifetimes. And I was sure having a more magnificent experience where I was than she was climbing her flight of steps. Yeah, the challenges tend to be kind of gauging your bodily functions and like, am I getting so tired that it's dangerous? You know, should I push that extra 3 miles or should I camp here? So there's a constant monitoring that goes on to prevent disaster because any misstep could mean a broken ankle. You know, it's treacherous country. There are rattlesnakes. You do see the occasional bear. I was going to be out about 2.5 weeks, and it was through Kings Canyon National Park. The trip was about 160, 175 miles, all told. So I had it all written down. I gave a copy of the itinerary to the ranger. He stapled it to my permit. So after a couple days, I got on the John Muir Trail, heading north. But 40, 50 people a day, it's not really a wilderness experience. So I had circled around as per my planned route, and I was headed down towards a place called the Tehipite Valley, which is where I eventually fell. This was, for me, the most exciting part of the trip because by then I was really strong. You know, I was used to life on the trail. My legs were really strong, and I was going to surge through those last 4 days into the most beautiful place of all and then come up out this grueling climb and back to the trailhead where my car was. So it was kind of the finale, the crescendo. The day I came down into the Tehipite Valley, I'd hiked about 10 miles. It's an extremely steep place. It's as deep as the Grand Canyon. I mean, it plunges straight down a vertical mile, and the Tehipite is as deep as that. So a very steep trail down, very overgrown. I was staying with the trail for the most part, but then I had lost it temporarily, and I was zigzagging back and forth wanting to find the trail again because when I'm alone, I like to be on the trail in case something should happen. I was coming down and looking forward to getting to the canyon floor, and I was groping around with one foot, watching where I was going for terra firma and holding on to a tree and a rock. And I put my right foot out to feel for firm ground, holding on with my right and my left hand. My foot went out from under me. The rock gave way. The tree gave way. And I had nothing in my hands, nothing under my feet. And I was falling in free fall. Never forget that feeling of nothing to grab onto, you know, nothing even to reach for, just down. I saw the rock coming up from below, gray. I saw a solid rock next to me, gray rock, nothing to grab onto. And I just thought, so this is how it ends. And I was vastly disappointed in that moment. And then there I was, laying on the bottom.
And so, Amy has had to tell this story again and again, to the media, to friends, and I guess part of the fascination is in the details. You're in the wilderness. You're damaged. It's going to be at least 4 days before anyone would actually notice that you're not where you're supposed to be. And so what are the details? The stuff that's as concrete as doing the dishes. The details of survival.
I was alive. I expected not to have that moment ever. Where I go, I'm alive, and then I was. It's like, I'm alive. What do I do now? I started patting my own body to ascertain the injuries, and I started with my face and my head, and I thought I had a broken nose, but lots of people do. Chipped tooth, you know, no serious damage on the face. I could move my neck and my hands, and I looked down, and I was laying on, both legs were bent. I was laying on the bent legs, and the most obvious injury was this bone that was sticking out of my right leg. I thought, that's not good. sticking like right through the skin, and I realized it was my skin, you know, my bone. So I poured some peroxide on it and wrapped it up, hope tightly enough to staunch the bleeding. And I put every piece of spare clothing I had around it to kind of pad it. And then I just didn't think about it anymore. I couldn't see it. It wasn't going to help to think about it, so I just ignored it. I couldn't move my hip without fairly excruciating pain, but I kind of pulled my legs out of the streamlet. I was in like a trickle of water because I couldn't stay in the water. I'd freeze, and kind of sat myself upright and went, okay, I can move my toes. I remembered somewhere that was a good sign. By then, I was shaking uncontrollably. I'm like, shock. I'm going into shock. And my pack had fallen a few feet away from me, my backpack with all my gear. It had come detached during the fall, and I could reach it by stretching out an arm and grab it to me. So I got out my little stove and boiled some water. There was water nearby, and made some soup and just kind of chugged it like medicine, and then pulled my sleeping bag over me and kind of passed out into sleep. And that was the first day of the fall. Well, I spent the next 2 days trying to sort of scoop myself down this stream bed into which I had fallen, because I believed that I was close to the floor of the canyon, and I knew from my map that there was a trail that ran along the floor of the canyon. I could lay in the trail, and if anybody came by, they would see me. At the end of the third day, I came to a place where I couldn't go any farther. I could only get my butt up off the ground about an inch or two at a time, just using my hands. And there was a bank that was about 6 inches tall and a bunch of boulders and trees. And I tried for hours, but I couldn't get myself over them. So I realized I wasn't going any farther and I would just have to stay where I was. So I sat myself down in a stream bank and kind of carved it out to get as comfortable as possible. And I still couldn't really think about this is as far as I can go. I just thought I'd do something tomorrow. And I sat down to make dinner. I was still calling out periodically, calling out, help me. I'm ready to be rescued now. Help. I hadn't brought my whistle with me, but I yelled, it's the only thing I could think of that I could have done differently. You know, everything I did was right. It was just a really unfortunate accident. Just one really bad step. The only thing I could think of was I should have brought a whistle. Whether or not that would have helped, I don't know. But I thought a lot about how will I succumb. I thought about dehydration, so I stayed near the water and made sure I drank a lot of it. I thought about food, but, you know, I'm an American. I could probably go without eating for a good 3 months before I became really emaciated. I wasn't concerned about wild animals too much because I sort of understand those dangers, and I did have my food in my bear canister. I kept a pile of rocks nearby in my pots. That's what you're supposed to do. You throw rocks at the bear and bang your pot, and then they go away. I thought about if my leg became infected, I might have to tie a tourniquet tightly, looking for like veins shooting up the leg. And I thought, if I lose my leg, which I surely will, if I have to tourniquet it, do I still want to be rescued? And I did. I really did. The biggest thing I was going to miss was the people that I loved that I thought I wouldn't get to see anymore. That was the biggest regret, that I wouldn't ever get to be with them. But I really couldn't think about that. I couldn't think of the horror of impending death. I couldn't think about the bones sticking out of the skin. So I thought about, okay, I'm going to go to that rock next. And then it will be time to have a drink of water. And, you know, now I'm going to read 10 pages of my book. I mean, I just had to really focus in and just kind of keep going and not broaden the spectrum too much. Just kind of keep it narrow and keep it in the moment and concentrate on what I could do. I did a lot of praying. I'm kind of an equal opportunity prayer. So I sort of tune into anybody or anything that might be of a higher good that might be around and willing to help me in some way. I didn't get any kind of a take that my praying for my own life was going to be particularly helpful. It's more like when your time's up, it's up. That's just it. But I did have a distinct impression that how much I cared was really going to make a difference. It's sort of the reverse of some of the spiritual traditions that teach non-attachment. But I found that I was really attached to continuing to live in as much as I could make that possible. So I determined to do anything that I could. I really cared. I really wanted to be alive. I didn't give it a high likelihood, but I was going to do all that I could. I'm sitting there kind of randomly. All these last 3 days I've been calling out occasionally. Not a lot of hope of people going by, because the ranger had told me when I got my permit, only a handful of people go there a year. So I was sitting there making some soup for dinner and calling out, "Help me, help." And I heard this faint little toot, toot. I thought, there's somebody out there. And in the next course of an hour and a half, I would hear the whistle. Sometimes I would hear people calling. I couldn't make out the words. I went crazy at that point because I figured this was the chance and maybe the only chance I was going to get. And I couldn't move, but I banged on my pots and I hollered at the top of my lungs and sometimes just screamed for top volume. And I carved a megaphone out of my water carrier, hoping that would help, and just anything so that I could continue to attract the attention of whoever it was that was out there. And there were three hikers. It took them quite a while to find me and even longer to get to where I was because I was basically surrounded by cliffs on all sides. But Jake, the guy who originally heard me, came climbing down this very steep hillside, and I saw the first human I'd seen in about 5 days now, and I just burst into tears because it was like a human being. He just came down and put his arm around me and said, "You're going to be all right. We're not going to leave you." Yeah, that was Jake. I wasn't actually in extreme pain until I was assured of my rescue and the rescue rangers got there with their helicopter basket. I'm not sure why that was. I sort of postulate it was a kind of a light shock, just my body's refusal to acknowledge the level of pain. Because it did become screaming pain after I was strapped into the helicopter basket. It was like, ah! But the 4 days prior to that, it was just, it was painful, but it registered as discomfort, like extreme discomfort, not, ah!
And now we're sitting in a friend's house where she's staying. She's moved from her bed to the living room with a walker and a knee about double the normal size for knees. And we talk about the challenges of recovery and of being one of the millions of Americans, like many of our friends and neighbors, who do not have medical insurance.
Well, the immediate situation is I have to ask for help with almost everything, which it's really hard for me to do. It's not my customary way. I'm very independent. I would much prefer to do almost everything myself than to ask somebody to help me with it. But I don't have a whole lot of choice right now. I mean, I can walk out to the living room now. It's only been a few days I could do that. You know, I won't be able to drive for months. So it's going to be a long, drawn-out opportunity to allow myself to be helped by people. I'm self-employed, and I have a couple of businesses, one of which has been kept going largely by the grace of my friends who put together work teams to fill the orders. So that's okay. The hospital bills are almost ludicrous. In the it'll be around $300,000 for putting me back together. Yeah, and I'm working through the process of figuring out what portion of that I'm realistically going to be expected to pay and how I'm going to do that. It's a little bit like falling to the floor at the canyon. You know, I can't really look at being perhaps $300,000 in debt, but I'm going to do everything that I can, as I did when I fell into the canyon, everything that I can. I wonder what my life will bring now. I don't have the answers to that. I do see that there were two miracles here. The first was I wasn't dead on impact, and the second miracle was that those hikers were walking by during that 5-minute time span that I was calling out, that they heard me. So I do believe that there's a purpose why I didn't die then and there, because it was extremely likely. That assures me that there is a purpose to the rest of my life. And it also assures me that what I've done up until now has not been a waste of time, has not been just wandering around in the dark. When I see the people that have come out to help me after the fall, people who I maybe encountered once 10 years ago for a brief amount of time, and they're like, wow, I remember you. You touched my life. And I just wanted to send my love. And, you know, sometimes they bring food or send money or just send their love or their prayers. But whatever it is, it's, I realized in the course of kind of randomly bopping through my life that there actually has been purpose, interwoven purpose. It's like, this is my darkest fear, you know, to have my body broken, to be financially incapable of caring for myself, and to have no way to help myself. And that's it. That's the darkest fear. Yeah, and when it actually happened, I was surrounded by friends and loved ones. They scooped me up collectively, carried me off, helped me to heal my body. They're helping me to straighten out my finances. They totally cared for my son, my house, my car. I didn't have to ask for any of it. I was just laying in the hospital bed. And they just came in a group and organized and, I mean, made a website and got everything that I would need. And just, I always thought I'd be alone, you know, in the darkest moment. Body destroyed, no way to care for myself. I'd be all alone. And it was so not like that. It was so the opposite of that. I get to be alive.
In Santa Rosa, California, we were talking with Amy Racina. Friends of Amy have set up a website to solicit help. That's at www.helpingamy.com.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.